Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
The Good Fork Restaurant in Red Hook, Brooklyn celebrates its 10th anniversary this month. And here to talk about that milestone are Chef Sohee Kim and her husband and partner, Ben Schneider. In addition to The Good Fork, Sohee and Ben own Insa Restaurant, a Korean barbecue restaurant in Gowanus. So we'll talk about that as well.
And in the second half of this show, we're all going to talk about Eric Repair's new book, 32 Yolks, and have a little book club round the table on that one.
Yes, that will be our first ever book club.
Yes. I still don't know if we should call it book club, but...
Sounds old. We could do like the NPR, the old NPR ladies from Saturday Night Live.
The kitchen, yeah.
Yeah, we could do that. Speaking of first of all, Sohee and Ben, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
You're our first couple that we've had on the show.
Check it out.
Obviously, you know, couples operating restaurants is something that goes way back in various forms. There's that old term, mom and pop.
Yep.
But I wonder if maybe just to start off, before we get to the milestone and everything else, can you both maybe just talk about that aspect of things and how that, I assume, in some ways makes it easier, and also maybe in some ways makes it more difficult to do what you two do?
Sure. I think it would be in my best interest to have my wife begin this conversation.
Okay.
Well, you know, a lot of people ask about it.
Yeah.
How do you deal with it, you know? And obviously, we spend a lot of time together, but I think that in our situation, it works because I'm the cook, I'm the chef, and that's my domain. So I deal with everything that is all back of the house, and Ben, you know, deals with stuff that's front of the house.
Uh-huh.
And then everything else in between, we get together and we discuss it. So I think it's a really good working relationship, and the yin and yang situation exists here.
Uh-huh.
And I think we balance each other out for the most part. Having said that, we do have two small children as well.
Oh, how old?
They are 8 and 6.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and as you said, you know, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary at the Good Fork. So it's been a very crazy, chaotic 10 years, very fast pace.
Sure.
But somehow we've, you know, made it all work.
Yeah. I mean, it helps that we have different roles in the restaurant. Yeah. I think if we were both in the kitchen, it would be problematic.
No way.
Because my skills are so incredible that it would just be intimidating for Sohee. Right. So it's good that I'm in the front bungling about, having had no experience in restaurants before opening the Good Fork.
We should probably mention you. How do we define your carpentry was your background?
I was an actor and a performer in kind of off Broadway type theater.
Yeah.
And I toured a bit with shows overseas. And then I was always, my day job as an actor was always as a woodworker and a cabinet maker.
So you were the Harrison Ford of downtown New York.
That's right.
Okay.
Exactly. And then But ironically, I had never, as an actor, I had never worked a day in my life in a restaurant before we wow. decided to open the Good Fork. So I thought that I could bartend and host and manage all at the same time. And my friend Francis Kerrigan still does a good impersonation of me just walking around in a circle doing none of those things.
Yes, exactly.
Just imploding.
Yeah, in like the first 2 weeks.
Like the colonel in the, you know, the Roman Red scene in History of the World.
Right, exactly.
But, well, two things. One is, you know, Jimmy's used this term a lot on this show that, you know, theater and restaurants are both curtain goes up type businesses.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So there is, I would imagine, a certain rhythm to the life that, you know, being in the restaurant business
yeah.
is traditionally and still to this day, even with all these evolutions that have happened in quality of life and all that, it's a relationship killer for a lot of people. So I would imagine that you were able to, you ended up working together, but understand the life that Zoe had and was living as a professional before you teamed up. And B, I imagine working together takes away a lot of the sort of resentments that can build up when someone, one person in a couple is in the restaurant business and the other person is what we in this room maybe would call a civilian, right?
Absolutely. And that's actually why we opened a restaurant.
Yeah.
Honestly, we were together and I was doing, you know, carpentry stuff and I would be up early and finish my day and then she would start her day in the evening and then when cooks get done with service, they need to kind of unwind and have a beer, and I was ready to go to sleep. It was not congruous at all.
Right.
And so I said, and plus I was looking for a new adventure as far as work goes, and so I said, let's both be in this business. Otherwise, this isn't going to work.
Right.
Well, that's not putting your toe in the pond. That's a full immersion for you.
Yeah.
Huh?
But you know
yeah.
what? I think truth be told, you know, 10 years ago when we started the Good Fork, neither one of us was really serious about it. And by that, I mean, obviously I was serious about my craft and Ben was serious about, you know, building a place and, you know, growing a family out of it. But I think in the initial stage was really like a project, like, hey, yeah. this is something fun that we could both do.
Sure.
I'll cook and you build it and you host, put on a nice shirt and, you know, we'll see where it takes us. But honestly, I think that the first week, you know, we're so exhausted. They're like 18-hour day, you know, we just go home and sort of like pass out on the bed. And I remember yeah. saying, I remember Ben, you saying to me, how long do we have to do this? And I was like, I don't know, maybe in 6 months, if we last that long, we'll get a review. And then, I don't know, maybe a year, honey. You know,
right.
year
for real.
Tops. For real. Like, you know, we didn't expect it to last. And I joke about that.
And you thought what? You might go back to working for other people?
Absolutely. Or? Absolutely. And it really was a, you know, the space became available. And when he said, okay, let's do this, I was like, no way. You know, and there was a part of me was fearful of what was to come. But
right.
it really, maybe you could add to this, but honestly, it really was an experiment. Like, let's do this fun project.
I have to ask if you can talk about it, but, you know, most leases aren't that. Was this some kind of Red Hook circa 2006 short-term, potentially open-ended business arrangement where that was actually a viable thing that you might have done to shut down after a
well,
certain period
of time? Well, we certainly signed a longer lease. But
well, it wasn't our plan to shut down.
Sure.
Obviously, you know, you're opening a business.
Yeah.
But we didn't anticipate that we would be open 10 years, that's for sure.
Right.
And I think that we went into it with a naive, romantic enthusiasm,
yeah,
which didn't
I mean.
Really look too far into the future,
right.
you know,
right.
one way or the other.
To me, it sounded a little bit more of some innocence instead of naivety.
Definitely.
You know, like there's so much pressure these days and people put pressure on themselves. I can open this business. It has to do this. I need this. I need that. We got to hire publicists. We got to, you know, best construction people or get it, you know,
right.
and there's so much front loaded weight on
right.
that. And, you know, it's all across America, but it's especially prominent in towns like this. And
right.
you don't often hear such refreshing tales of, you know, because a lot of businesses started like this, you know, like Starbucks coffee, you
That's
know,
right.
like
right.
they didn't start out to want to own the world. They right. wanted to make good cup of coffee for their friends,
right.
you know,
yeah.
so
I do
really
hope
cool.
there will be a Good Fork in Tiananmen Square at some point. Just for the record. But yes, that's exactly right. And I think our business plan, like in terms of like customer base, was like a list of our friends and how many times a week we thought they may or may not eat at our restaurant.
Right.
You know, it was
yeah.
not super well thought out on that
nope.
business level.
Mm-mm.
But it was one of those things where I think I wanted a project. I wanted a new building project. And I also love the idea of transitioning from having clients in the cabinet business who I was kind of wedded to for a long period of time, to having customers who were there for like 2 hours, and having that kind of a relationship in terms of my income. And then, you know, and I knew Sohee was very talented. So I knew that we had a fighting chance as a restaurant because I knew her food was going to be great.
So, yeah, it was definitely born out of that passion and support of one another and just wanting to spend more time, you know, together as a couple.
Yeah.
And everything else sort of fell into place, and I think a luck had a lot to do with it. And also the Good Fork being in Red Hook, I think, played a big part.
How so?
In that, you know, Red Hook is that's where we live, and yep. It's a very, it's a small town vibe.
Can you just, for people who are listening, sorry to interrupt, sure. But for people who are listening who aren't in New York, can sure. you just describe a little the Red Hook of 2006 when you guys opened?
Absolutely. Ben, I think you could do a better
job. You want me to do that?
Yeah.
Well, Red Hook is a neighborhood that's unusual because it's geographically cut off from the rest of the city in that it has no subway.
Yeah.
And it's also a peninsula. It sticks into the harbor. And so you can't really go through it to get somewhere. You kind of have to go into it and then back out again. So it really is kind of like a small seaside town culturally.
Right.
And it has, since we moved there in 2006, actually 2001 is when we moved there, it really is a place where you walk down the street and you don't just wave to neighbors, you stop and you talk to them. And you end up finding yourself in a party all of a sudden, you know, an impromptu barbecue because you ran into some people. It's
right.
like that. And so it's not a great place to do commerce, honestly. Like, there's no foot traffic in the winter.
Right.
It has improved greatly over time. When we opened, the Good Fork was right around the time that all the magazines were kind of writing about this new neighborhood, and we had a lot of people coming to visit. And now it's really on everybody's map in the city now,
right.
but it wasn't back then at all.
Right. Yeah. And it does take, I mean, I lived until last July in Brooklyn, and uh-huh. I mean, what you say about the subway is a huge, people who don't live in New York maybe can't grasp this, but, you know, most places, although it's funny, the subway was not really designed for modern Brooklyn and certainly not for modern Brooklyn restaurant goers. You know, to get from point A to point B can take three trains to
sure.
go like 2 miles.
Right.
But there is no, it's non-existent public transportation really. So you're either cabbing it, or if you have a car, you're maybe driving or you're hoofing it.
Well, we have a bus. We have the
B61
bus.
Yeah.
bus.
Yeah.
And, you know, New York is, for those who don't live in New York, is a strange place where people somehow think it's not okay to take the bus.
Yeah.
You know, all over the world, people take the bus.
Yeah.
So
and the
it
bus
is
a charming experience.
It depends.
Can be. If there's not some crazy...
Hey, you know, the bus will let you out wherever you want. You just pull the cord. So
that's right.
Anyway, but Sohee, we were talking a minute
ago. So, yeah, so I think Red Hook, you know, the fact that we lived in Red Hook and we started, you know, meeting our neighbors and really sort of setting roots down.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a cook, you know, working in the city at the fine dining institutions and Ben doing his woodworking and acting, we really thought that Red Hook needed, you know, we're so used to going into Manhattan for good food and entertainment. We're
yeah.
like, why not Brooklyn? And, of course, you know, like you said, Brooklyn is way different today than it was just merely 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So we looked around on Van Brunt Street, which is the main strip of Red Hook, and we said, why not a restaurant here? And back then, there was really only a handful, two that I could name.
Yeah, but there was one notable restaurant to talk about, which was 360.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Did you know 360?
Heard of it, yeah.
At all?
Heard of, yeah, sure.
It was a French restaurant owned by a gentleman named Arnaud, and they were kind of like the trailblazer, I would say, in terms of an elevated cuisine in Red Hook.
Yeah.
And they were open. We kind of overlapped for a few years. And then he somehow got a wisdom and enlightenment and got out of the restaurant business. he went down to Puerto Rico and works in the diving industry.
Uh-huh.
And I saw him at the bus stop one day when I was scurrying to the restaurant with a bag of dirty linens and four things had broken. And he was like relaxed and tan
yeah.
and happy.
The other side.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier you signed a longer lease. Is your first lease a 10-year lease?
Yep.
It is?
Yep.
And so what will be you were you able to is the I suppose the lease is up or came up?
Yeah, we are renewing it for another 10.
Congratulations. That's
Thank
fantastic.
You. Thank you.
Oh,
yeah,
that's super
that's
super
deal.
Duper duper.
It's a big deal. It's a
yeah,
deal.
No, let's just hope the neighborhood comes up around you and
it is.
Supports
it has,
you.
It has. And, yeah. you know, it has come around. You know, there's it's mixed use, the commercial, you know, residential stock in terms of apartments and houses, very limited.
Yeah.
But, you know, just like any other part of Brooklyn, there's, you know, there's a lot of new condos and,
sure.
and buildings that are being created.
West Chelsea was a lot
That's
like
right.
that, you know, 20 years, 18,
right.
17 years ago when we opened the Red Canyon. Subway goes to 10th Avenue, you
right.
know.
And That's right.
Working class neighborhood. And, you know, it isn't that now.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know, there's some similarities. I feel a little kinship with you. And, you know, our ambitions were perhaps a little bit different than yours in the beginning. You know, I was like, no, I want to have a neighborhood restaurant for like 25 years in the same building that never changes its concept and people just dig it, you know. So it was a little less innocent, but I also had the same thought, like, holy shit, I wonder if we stay in business, you know.
Right?
I mean, you know, I don't want to overstate that we didn't think we would stick around. I think we hoped we would stick around. We
sure.
just didn't expect we would.
Yeah.
And
well, it was less front-loaded,
yeah.
you know. Maybe less demanding expectations on yourself
yeah.
doesn't mean your desire was any
right.
different. You know?
But, you know, the thing that I wanted to stress, and you're right, you know, of course we'd hoped, you know, a go-to neighborhood joint, you know, in Red Hook that
right.
people would come to. And that's comforting and enticing for a lot of, you know, generations,
yeah.
you know, different types of people.
Well said.
But in the beginning, I think, you know, the point that I was trying to make is simply that we were very naive,
mm-hmm.
you know, we just didn't know quite exactly what we're getting into. And it took us 10 years. And of course, we're not done yet
right.
in figuring how, you know, figuring it all out
sure.
because it is such a process.
Well, I've heard lots of captains of industry say, if I knew now what I didn't know then, I wouldn't be in this business I'm in. So
right.
you're not alone in that one.
What kind of, I guess, sort of a stock taking or evaluation, like when you, 10 years is a huge, especially these days when so many, I mean, there was just this awful news this week that Low Life Restaurant, you know, after 6 months is gone. I mean, the competitiveness right now, the kind of short attention span of diners right now. You guys had a traumatic, I assume, period of time. You guys were shut down by Hurricane Sandy. For how long were you guys down?
Exactly 2 months.
Okay.
Because Hurricane Sandy was October 29th, and we're up with our first service for New Year's Eve that
right.
year. So, and that's, you know, only because Ben's, you know, he rebuilt it. And
right.
He built the restaurant initially. And if we were just regular restaurateurs, you know, looking out for, a contractor
sure.
or somebody to help us out, that would have taken at least 5 or 6 months.
Especially at that time when there are lots of people
That's
competing
right.
for those services.
That's right. I mean, really, credit to Ben. He was out there, you know, 16-hour days.
So, you know, the 10-year milestone comes up and you decide you're going to I mean, what kind of soul-searching, stock-taking happens as you look to another 10 years?
Well, I think that, I'll let you speak to it once. I think that we did have some moments in the past few years where I think we thought about, well, what's next? You know, is it time to not have the stress in our life?
Right.
And instead we decided to double down.
Right, and open another place.
And open
yeah.
another
yeah.
place
right.
and grow. And the idea for us, I think, is to grow enough that we've always considered it to be a collaborative art from the beginning.
Yeah.
And the thing about a collaborative art is, you know, everyone needs to be taken care of, and we want to do that as well as possible.
Yeah.
And so what we wanted to do was, rather than focus only on the Good Fork and try and squeeze every drop out of a stone, because a small restaurant can only create so much revenue.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to be there all the time working the line and working the floor, you just can't really make a decent living. Even if you're successful, and even if, you know, if you want to pay people as well as possible,
yeah.
You really, so we thought, well, how do we keep the Good Fork going? Maybe we open another place to expand the product.
Mm-hmm.
If you will.
It's a logical thought.
Yeah. So that the thought of doing a second place was actually connected to the, on
yeah.
the oncoming arrival of this milestone
exactly.
anniversary.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And in a desire to kind of keep the Good Fork beautiful and strong and wonderful,
yeah.
and not have this kind of feeling of like paranoia of like, oh my God, how do we make a living out of this thing, and
yeah.
being sort of obsessive about it.
Right.
And
yeah.
it, you know, the year we built out the new place, INSA, was a hard year for the Good Fork because we had a lot of our attentions focused
sure.
over there. And I cannot speak strongly enough to the kind of support from our staff who kind of got it. What
yeah.
we were trying to do,
yeah.
and let us slide, you know, at our Christmas party, They did Adele's Hello, but it was all about like being forsaken and not getting change delivered anymore, and like nobody cares about us.
Right,
and,
right.
But it was really in good fun, and they really were behind the whole effort.
So can you speak for a minute? You worked in some pretty disparate places. First of all, you were originally from Korea.
Mm-hmm.
You worked at Blue Hill. Mm-hmm. You spent some time with the Batali Bastianich Group.
Yep.
You worked for our friend Anita Lowe and
Anissa.
You know, your the style of the menu at Good Fork, it's some people would call it eclectic. I don't know how defining that is these days. It's a very personal menu.
Sure.
How did you... over the years when you were working for others, go about honing the style that you put out there at the Good Fork? Were you cooking kind of at home? Were you keeping a notebook of ideas? How did you go about evolving on your own as you were working for other people?
Right. So I think any, you know, young cook really hungry to learn always keeps that little black notebook, you know, in the breast pocket. And you just jot down whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever recipe, you know, that the chef that you're working for admires is working on. So you just, it's a sponge.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I first started cooking, I was in my late 20s, and I was a career changer, as they called me.
Mm-hmm.
Trying something new, and I just felt like I had, I just had to catch up, you know. So, you know, I moved on. Like, you know, I got a good advice from a chef one time. It's like, I know it's really grueling work, it's hard work, and, you know, you don't get paid much, and we all know that's the truth, you know, of the industry. It was, and hopefully it'll change, and I think it is changing. So I always stayed one year, you know, saw how a chef dealt with, you know, ingredients for four seasons. And then you would politely sort of move on.
Yeah.
So I took a lot of notes, and my, you know, the thing that I wanted to focus on was technique. And I just wanted to absorb as much as I could from all these wonderful chefs that I learned. And, you know, a lot of do's and a lot of, like, how not to do, you know, as well.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, when I met Ben and, you know, we always sort of talked about, jokingly, like I said, about opening up a restaurant, I sort of imagine a globe-trotting menu. And so, yeah, I think the first year we opened the Good Fork, you know, Zagat's had us, you know, under eclectic new American. But it was really, you know, it was sort of ballsy, I feel like, in a way. Looking back, I was like, I had some nerve to put, like, dumplings, like homemade dumplings next to a wild boar ragu, which things people weren't doing at the time. But, Ben and I sort of looked at each other. I was like, let's just make a menu that whatever we want to eat.
Yeah, it came from the heart.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It makes sense that something that comes straight from the heart,
that's right,
done well, is going
to
make people really happy.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. And, I feel like I was nervous in the beginning. You know, my brother, I say this in the cookbook that's coming up, but my brother was like, are you absolutely bonkers and out of your mind? You can't write a menu like this. It's
in more ways than one.
Right.
I bought this thing and I wrote that menu.
And so, but I was like, no, I think it'll work because it does, you know, come from, you know, a good place in our heart. And I feel like this is a way that people would like to eat. That's the way that I want to eat. So, you know, why not?
It's so funny. You know, this is kind of an interesting dovetail into Eric's book that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But, you know, in that book, there's several instances where people say to him, you know, or he says of somebody's cooking, even if it's at home, you know, he talks about his step grandmother, you know, she always cooked with love, you know, the love in the food. And it's so funny because it does sound, even as I'm saying it, sounds a little corny.
Sure.
It sounds a little cliched. You know, I spent some time writing about the Bocuse d'Or competition years ago for a book. And, you know, there's this thing that anyone around the Bocuse, I would always say, well, why don't you just get, like in the U.S., why don't we have Thomas Keller and Danielle create the freaking menu and then just let the cook execute the menu? And people who have been around that competition will always say it has to be their own food. The guy in the competition booth or the woman in the competition booth, it has to be their own food or it won't taste, it won't come out right.
It won't translate.
Lost, you know,
in translation.
But this is a really hard thing to explain, isn't it, to
it
lay
is.
People? Like, I accept it as fact.
But it's the difference.
But I almost
between...
even don't even understand it completely. It's a, it's almost a spiritual notion.
It is.
But we're not making widgets.
Right.
It's got to come from the soul.
And when you're talking about, you know, what kind of chef you want to be, the identity or the type of food, like, you know, that's, I feel like for a chef, it's really, it's, you have to make a choice at a certain point. You take all the knowledge that you've gained over the years. in your training, and to how to, you know, and juggle all that and sort of weave it into something that is wholly yours and only yours. And that, that a lot of that has to do with that passion that, that you talk about. In Korean, in Korea, we have this term called sonmat, which means a taste of the hand. So, and that's a very, it's a very and it's very much, you know, the heart of the Korean cuisine is, you know, you could give somebody, and I think this is true in any professional kitchen, you could give a cook a recipe and it could taste totally different from another cook that you give the same recipe to.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it really is, you know, I love that phrase.
Well, I'll go back to, to Thomas again. You know, one of my favorite lines anywhere is in the opening of the French Laundry cookbook.
Right.
He has this line saying, "There's a do you know the line? I mean, it's there's always been I can't quote it, but there's always been some kind of a gap between a recipe and cooking.
Right.
And the culminate and the end of the little paragraph is recipes have no soul.
Right.
Right. You That's bring right. that to the most well written recipe ever. You're still going to bring yourself
That's
to the
right.
to the actual cooking.
Well,
That's
also
right.
there's like this culinary school angle. Like, okay, so you're a culinary school grad, or let's even say you're in culinary school and you have a partner in your station and you've never worked in a restaurant, but your partner's worked in a restaurant. Who's going to have more retention? Who's going to get it more quickly? And who's probably going to put it into their soul more quickly? You know, you have a little experience.
Yeah.
And you have a little, you know, passion or guidance, maybe even self-imposed.
You can
really come out ahead a lot of times instead of just making somebody else's food.
We're going to take a break in a minute, but before we do, this show lives on in perpetuity on the Heritage website and on iTunes. But if you're listening to this show before June 16th, 2016, on that day, you guys are having an anniversary, special anniversary occasion at the Good Fork.
We are.
Can you just tell people about this and how they would join that if they wanted to?
Two Sundays ago, and this is past history, but we had a big pig roast sort of blowout with four bands and a lot of beer. This is going to be more about the food history of the food at the Good Fork. Just that particular night is a Thursday night. We're going to do a greatest hits tasting menu, five courses for $65. You know, anyone who wants to come can just call the restaurant and make a reservation.
Great, great. So we encourage everybody to do that. We are talking with Chef Soe Kim and with Ben Schneider of the Good Fork and INSA in Brooklyn, New York. And when the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew returns, we're going to, I won't call it a book club, Jimmy. We're going to talk about...
Well, speaking of book club, what is the name of your book?
It's called The Good Fork Cookbook.
And when will it be out?
November 1st.
Oh,
published
congratulations.
Put out by Abrams.
I can't wait. Yeah. It's going to be a great old school cookbook. Dense, beautiful.
Can people pre-order yet?
Absolutely.
It's already up. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can also go to Amazon and support these guys. we're going to come right back and talk about Eric Repair's new memoir, 32 Yolks, when the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew comes back right after this break.
Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Restaurant Owner App empowers you to organize your restaurant from the palm of your hand on any iPhone or Android device. Place orders, track orders, and customize supply lists to track the organization of your kitchen or storeroom. Accomplish electronically what you've been doing by hand for years. Restaurant Owner App also allows you to see orders placed by your employees, so you're always in the know. Create a personalized vendor database and review past orders at any time. It also features promotions and specials on goods and services for the hospitality trade. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more information. Or to download for free and start organizing your restaurant today, search for Restaurant Owner App in the Apple App Store or in Google Play for Android phones.
Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We're talking with Chef Soe Kim and with Ben Schneider, both of the Good Fork and INSA restaurants in Brooklyn, New York. And we're going to now turn our attention to Eric Repair's memoir, 32 Yolks, From My Mother's Table to Working the Line, which was released just a few weeks ago. The memoir tracks Eric's life from early childhood until his departure from France to the United States in 1989. It not only details his formative working years, but also an often distressing and very sad personal life. Jimmy, were you surprised how open Eric was about a lot of the details of his childhood, his parents, their divorce, the other relationships that their parents had? There's a huge focus on the personal in this book.
Right. You know, I think it goes a little bit back to the spiritual raw and the cooked, you know. He seems to be pretty far along on the spiritual path, so that would make him a cooked spiritual player, if
right,
you will.
Right.
And, you know, knowing that, I wasn't terribly surprised. You know, there's freedom in sharing, as Ben was speaking about earlier, and so he. And to tell half the story isn't going to do anything for anybody. And then if you look at his body of work, that man doesn't do anything halfway. You know, so if you're spiritually, you know, aware and you're, you know, operating at the highest level you can operate at, it didn't surprise me that he was able to speak to it all. I was surprised about a lot of the aspects of his upbringing and his childhood and growing up, and then of his you know, culinary upbringing as well. There's some heavy stuff in that book. You know, one of the things to me from reading it was there's so many of these tales of, you know, misfortune or adversity at home, and, you know, finding your solace in the kitchen. And I think, you know, one of the ways was, I don't know, just being connected.
Yeah, well, it's funny. The first line of the book, which is obviously no accident, right? Two things happened the year I turned 11. My father died, and I became friends with my first professional chef, a guy named Jacques. And it's, I think, we've talked about this a lot on this show. We're only, you know, not even 20 episodes of this podcast. But how often have we talked about you know, the kitchen and restaurants as sort of surrogate families.
Yeah, and,
you know?
And finding comfort in the order of that. You know, that was right after his father died, and, you know, the first thing his mom did was, let's do food.
Right, let's go out for a great dinner.
That was Josh Ozersky's thing when we were talking about
it.
Oh, you know, mom's dead, let's go have some pizza.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about food. And
not
in a callous way, but that was how he related to his son. And so Eric's father passed, and you know, the first thing his mom did is bring him to this restaurant where this crazy French chef who was ex-military was doing, you know, Vietnamese spring rolls in a small town in France while, you know, making a chocolate, what's it called?
Souffle.
Chocolate mousse.
Mousse, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry. You know, it's funny. We've talked, you know, we talked about some documentaries a few weeks ago. We're really excited. In 2 weeks, we're going to have David Gelb, who produces and directs many of the segments for Chef's Table.
That's going to be amazing.
But, you know, there really is right now, and so, and Ben, I'd love to talk to you two about this, but, you know, there really is this real glut right now, which is, I mean this in actually a good way. Glut, I guess, is a negative word.
Well, there's an abundance it went from 0 to 60.
Yeah, there's an abundance of material out there about the chef life, you know, like when Tony Bourdain wrote Kitchen Confidential, that was kind of a radical thing, like what he was taught. And now everyone sort of knows a lot of this stuff, you know, in this book. And what I think's so remarkable about it is, you know, you do read it. And if you've read enough books, even if you're not around the profession like we all are, you know, a lot of the marks along the way are kind of familiar. Like, you kind of know he's going to get his ass kicked in the kitchen, and then he's going to figure out how to make the hollandaise, and he's going to this. And you kind of know what's coming, because it's what comes for any successful chef.
Right.
But when we talked about a couple of documentaries recently, we were saying, you know, what's the thing that really makes each one, you know, it's like a lot of people say of cookbooks, you know, if a cookbook has one great takeaway recipe, it's probably worth it, right?
Right.
Or one great piece of information, it's probably was worth getting the book. And to me, what this book has, and, you know, there's lots of chefs who could tell very similar stories, and for whatever reason don't. But I think this unsparing depiction of the culture of a three-star, well, early in the book, it's actually an aspiring three-star restaurant. When he is working for Jules Robuchon in Paris, and the brutal description of the kitchen, of how Robuchon talks to the staff, of the staff having to cook dinner for his dog, of of his just unbelievable perfectionism and what that did to people. I mean, he describes people going into the hallway and punching the wall and people
crying,
and how he would himself come home. And I guess for you, I mean, when you worked in some high caliber kitchens, mm-hmm. nothing really at that extreme
right.
end. But when you hear or read all this stuff, I mean, what does it seem like to you? Does it seem like it comes from another age? Does it seem just crazy? Does it seem like that's what it takes? As someone who was a cook and now been a chef, your own chef for a while,
right?
How does it all just play with you?
Right. So I have to admit that when I was going to culinary school, I was voracious. I just wanted to consume, as much as I could. And I read a lot of books. And one of the books was Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential.
Sure.
And I read that, and I was like, I don't want to do that. It just, it's very macho, and the writing is funny. And I think Anthony Bourdain is a super guy. But the depiction of the kitchen was very male driven, I just wanted to focus on the food. Early on, I wanted to seek out different types of restaurants. But, along the way, you definitely do, especially as a female cook, you learn to walk into a kitchen that is all male and act a little tougher, because that is what's expected of you. And I knew that I didn't want to focus on pastry, so I carried myself a little differently.
Yeah.
And then along the way, you build your own resume and your own experiences, of dealing with various people that you don't want to be dealing with, but you have to anyway, because you spend 12 hours with these people. So this whole forced family situation, it's definitely present. But then sometimes magic happens, and then you really bond with that person.
Yeah.
So all of that is experience. With this, the 32 Yoke book, I thought it was just amazing to read about his actual story, what happened to him, what drove him, all the sad things that happened and how it added to his passion and how it fueled him professionally.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, chefs these days, I joke with other restaurateurs, what happened? Where's the work ethic? You know what I mean? And you sort of look back to what these guys had to deal with in the 80s and 70s and beyond. It goes all the way back to history.
Hundreds of years.
Yeah,
it's all we know.
Abuse, basically.
Yeah, this is this whole new system.
Totally.
Andrew and I were talking about this on the way over today, If the industry has existed in what they call the brigade system, loosely translates, it's basically a military style of leadership. Do as I say, and that's all there is to it. That's
right.
All your boss needs to say to you, and you do it, and that's that. And if you don't do it, you either go home and you stand in the corner and you don't speak to somebody for a week. But that's the extent of it. And, we have lots of people on the show. We've been talking all year about this enlightenment in the kitchen. You alluded to it. We need to pay people more. We need to treat people better. In theory, every business runs differently.
And conversely, we talked about the tragedy of Chef Violet, who could kill himself.
Second you get to the pinnacle, what do? You know the next thing that's going to happen is you're probably going to get knocked off at some point. And, we don't know what happened there, but there's more high-end chefs taking themselves out than there are, not high-end chefs is my guess.
Yeah, but I'd love for you, Zoe and Jimmy, for people who aspire to that level of craft, mm-hmm. right, to that extreme
level. The highest level.
Yeah. Right. When you hear details like this in the book, and when you hear what's demanded of cooks in those types of kitchens, and it really is almost like a prison thing.
Sure.
He's talking about everyone would hide their mise en place. One guy would hide stuff in the inside of a fish, and how Eric would take to making three terrines. So when chef noticed that the tarragon in one of them wasn't bright green, he had a backup, and it was hidden.
It's the highest level of discipline.
It's crazy, but is that what's called for? Everyone loves to talk today about, how the working conditions are better, and you don't push people for, you don't work 16, 18 hours, 6 days in a row, but can you get the same level of cook without doing that?
I think you can. And I think a lot of us talking about, you know, the way it was back then, you know, the history of it all, it's harsh and it's also romantic, you know, oh, I put in, you know, X amount of years.
War stories.
War stories. Yeah. And I don't think in order to be a good soldier, you need to have, you know, experienced many wars, you know, so long as you're focused and you're dedicated.
So you think you can have the drive personally to want to be that good?
Absolutely. Is it less, you know, is it harder to find those, you know, few that are personally motivated and driven? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But I don't think, to answer your question, that it's necessary.
Yeah.
I think also you have to distinguish between style, leadership style, and culture, and work ethic.
Yeah, that's
and
what I think, wanted to get into.
I think that, you know, you worked under chefs who were at the higher end, but who did not have that style, that kind of prison, you know, commander style. Yeah. You can still be a strong leader and not do that. I think that what you alluded to earlier, though, about work ethic is what we do see with the sort of cultural food revolution in this country is young cooks who they want to be the chef too quick.
Yeah.
And they don't want to spend the time peeling the onions, you know.
No work ethic. Yeah.
And so the work still needs to get done.
Yeah.
Whether you are being, you know, dressed down and humiliated, you know, a la Full Metal Jacket or not,
right,
is a whole other issue.
Yeah.
I say you can't take a shortcut to greatness, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I'll come back on the point. So he was saying, I agree with what you're saying. I think Andrew is making a larger point. Maybe I'm right or maybe I'm wrong, but in the sense of the greatest restaurants in America, the greatest restaurants in the world, there's something like, you know, 50,000 restaurants in New York City, and there's something like 7 four-star New York Times restaurants. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we're talking a little bit more about maybe the 3 stars. You know, I think there's maybe 22 3-star restaurants, and there's maybe 300 or 400 2-star restaurants. Talk about the top ones. You know, there's probably 10 million restaurants in the world, and there's probably 600 mm-hmm. that are of that highest rating. And I might even be well overstating that. It might be 300 of the highest echelon restaurants in the world. So if you want to work on that level, the supreme highest level that you could possibly offer someone or work on or impose on yourself, you need some discipline.
Absolutely.
That you're not going to get from just you know, freewheeling it and feeling good about it.
Right.
You're going to need a backbone and a foundation that you might not possess, and you might not know how to get there.
Right.
And you're probably not going to get there, which is why we know the military system in the kitchen works. You know, it doesn't work for every kitchen. Don't get me wrong when I say that, but if you want to work on the highest level,
no, but
you better know you're going to pay your dues, because that's all that ever happens.
Paying dues, for sure. Right. I believe in that. But the way that some kitchens are, you know, the culture of a certain kitchen is you know, outfitted is just, it's based on cruelty,
no,
I feel like.
And, you know, that's a great point, because Robichon, in the book, Repair, speaks about Robichon, and he would just belittle you in front of everybody. I worked in this kitchen in Philadelphia, and it was similar in the sense that the cooks would discipline each other, but they wouldn't do it in a bad way. So if you were, there was 19 cooks in this kitchen. Mm-hmm. If you were 5 minutes late to work, every cook would give you a hard time, and you'd have to say you're sorry for them. If you put a dish up in the window that wasn't perfect, the person on the left and the right of you would look at you and say, "You serve that shit to your mother?" So you're right in the sense that there's different ways of doing it, whether it comes from below or it comes from above. I tend to think, as with everything else in life, a little bit of both is going to get you to where
Absolutely.
You want to go. And there is no supreme need to just dress people down all the time.
Right.
Right? Because, you know, you would, like you're saying, sharing, you know, you enlist people to help with your cause.
Right.
And they might not do it the way you do it. You know, no cook ever spoke to me when they were yelling at me like the chef. The chef would just stand there and scream at you. And if you stopped looking at him, then somebody else would come over and scream at you next. So either way you looked, you were looking at somebody who was screaming at you.
The fascinating thing to me is, you know, and I think it's no accident, there's a reference late in the book to Officer and a Gentleman, which is an old film, but and I won't say where the reference comes in, but, you know, for anyone who's seen it, and I have to say, and I'm sure Eric would want us to say, he does, after all these stories, say, this guy was my hero, you know? And I did think it was no accident that there's this reference to Officer and a Gentleman. There was this drill sergeant played by Lou Gossett Jr., who absolutely torments Richard Gere, you know, and then at the end they have this, like, tearful moment at, you know, on graduation day.
And in the book, Repair thanks a couple people, too. You know, there's a man who was pretty stern with him and really driven and just puts him in his corner all the time. And he's one of the people in the book. He says, hey, listen, I wouldn't be where I am right now without you doing what you did for me. I didn't think about it then, and I didn't feel good then. But right now, and he writes, you know, merci, Jean.
Yeah.
Sure.
So really interesting. Wish we had more time to talk about the book. It is 32 Yokes by Eric Repair, recently released. We recommend it. It's a really good read. And for people who, again, to me, it's not just, I mean, to me, this was the sort of defining aspect of it, was this look that maybe because he's in a position of equality or near equality now to Robichaud, he felt comfortable enough to do this. There's hundreds of guys who could tell stories like this about similar kitchens.
Sure.
And a few have, but I think the degree that he goes into this and the way he explains how you develop, you really watch the stages of development. You watch throughout this book somebody, you really get a sense of how information is conveyed. This is one of the great things I think about the profession that you all are in, is how things are sort of conferred, you know, orally, how it's like passed down in this mentor situation.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
There's always so much you can get from a book or from school, or really get the sort of again, you say all these things and they sound cliched, but this quest for knowledge that Eric was on for the first X number of years of his career, and you really see it almost like a Polaroid very slowly happening before your eyes.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the things that's qualifying for me is, listen, Repair's had 4 stars since 94. I don't know very many people at all in this country, if not in this world, that have continually held 4 stars since, for, you know, 22 years.
Yeah.
You can say whatever you want. You know, Kid Rock says it ain't cocky if you back it up. So that's it.
On that note, we have been talking with Chef Zoe Kim and with Ben Schneider of The Good Fork, celebrating their 10th anniversary this week. Again, congratulations. Great meeting you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And again, if you want to attend the anniversary dinner on June 16th, get in touch with the restaurant. Next week's show, we're going to have, we always love this, people who are from another city. We're going to have Benjamin and Max Goldberg of the Catbird Seat and many other restaurants in Nashville, Tennessee, here in the studio.
Yes.
They've just opened 2 new places, and we'll get into that and see what's going on in Nashville these days. We would like to thank our engineer, David. David, thank you very much for piloting the ship. And also a huge thanks, as always, to our sponsor, Restaurant Owner App. And with that, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we'll see you back here next week on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.